session, Judge Werke, Judge Larkin, Judge Flory, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Go ahead and take a seat. The court is aware that the next two matters that are going to be heard are interrelated. We'll certainly give you plenty of time to reassemble yourselves. However, because of the volume of cases that we're addressing today, we need to keep moving forward. With that said, I'll ask Mr. Huff to call the next case for consideration.
Calling case number 8191389, In Re, the adoption petition of AMG and JLG.
Counselor, both familiar with appellate procedure. So with that said, Mr. Fidler, when you're ready to proceed, you can approach the podium.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Fidler, and I represent Michael and Anita Gullard. I think we all know what their names are because the cases are consolidated. And they are the guardians for the four Rett's children. The argument today is not about whether we can adopt. It's just about who has jurisdiction about that proceeding. And I know there's complicated issues in the adoption itself about who's a parent, you know, what the substantive rights are. But the question before you, I would submit, is just simply who has jurisdiction and whether the Judge Tilmany properly transferred the case to tribal court in her order. We have a very simple argument, Your Honor, and that's that we think the transfer order was an error of law, and the court erred by applying Minnesota Statute 260.771 subdivision 3B to transfer proceedings to tribal court. So what happened was, as we filed our adoption petition, we gave notice to the tribe of the filing because it is an adoptive placement proceeding under ICWA. We accept that. And we showed up at oral argument, and the court on its own did its research and came across the RS decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, which said that adoption cases are not transferable to tribal court. And I said, that's correct, Your Honor, and that was the end of it. So it came as a surprise to us when we got the order stating that that case did not apply and that the case was transferred to tribal court.
Did you have an opportunity to offer argument in the district court after receiving that argument order?
We did not, Your Honor, and in fact,
it was sua sponte, unnoticed, no opportunity to argue.
Exactly, it was sua sponte, and I pointed out to the court, you know, that after the order came out, as the court's aware, motions to reconsider are not permitted without permission of the court. So I wrote a letter to the court and said, the Supreme Court said that federal law prohibits transfer. The legislature disagreed. I think there's a question about preemption and separation of powers, and the matter should be argued.
And did you have argument then?
No. The motion to reconsider was denied, or the request to reconsider was denied.
Can I ask you a question about the statute? As I look at RS, I think I understand what the holding there is. That seems to pretty clearly say that under ICWA, the tribal court does not have jurisdiction over adoptive, pre-adoptive placements, adoptive placements of Indian children who are not domiciled or residing on the reservation. So that's the jurisdictional law. And now we have the statute that comes after RS that says the court shall transfer the proceeding to the jurisdiction of the tribe. That is a pre-adoptive or adoptive placement of an Indian child not residing or domiciled on the reservation.
Right.
The question I have about this statute is this a statute that creates jurisdiction in the tribe, or is this statute a statute that simply says if a tribe has jurisdiction, you transfer the hearing to the tribal court? So in that sense, it's consistent with RS. And the reason I ask that is because another portion of the statute, 3A, which concerns good cause for denying a transfer request, mm-hmm. says the court may find good cause to deny transfer to tribal court if The Indian Child's Tribe does not have a tribal court or any other administrative body of a right. tribe vested with authority over the child custody proceedings as defined by the Indian Child Welfare Act, to which the case can be transferred. So I'm reading those two provisions together and wondering if all this statute says is you shall transfer if there's a tribal court with jurisdiction to hear the matter.
Right.
And RS says tribal court doesn't have jurisdiction. So this isn't, you know, a case where the legislature has tried to overrule RS, but merely has put in place a statute which can be applied in a way that doesn't conflict with RS. Mm-hmm. Which would then still lead to a conclusion that the district court erred because there was good reason to deny a transfer because RS tells us the tribal court doesn't have jurisdiction.
Right. I think that's a very good point, Your Honor. What RS recognized and we litigated the whole issue of jurisdiction very thoroughly in RS, and it was pointed out that for some reservations in Minnesota, tribes have totally exclusive jurisdiction, and that was not a creation of ICWA. That was pre-existing federal law, case law, Fisher versus District Court, United States Supreme Court.
Tribal court here have pre-existing jurisdiction to determine the pre-adoptive placement issue?
For a reservation that has exclusive jurisdiction, I would say that they had pre-existing jurisdiction for cases that are domiciled on the reservation.
Okay. That's the difference here, though.
Right. But in this case, the tribe had an order discharging its jurisdiction. The children moved off the reservation to Detroit Lakes.
When they were initially adopted? That order, is that the order you're talking about?
Right. They were initially adopted in tribal court.
And they moved off reservation land, and they're still in Becker County, but...
Okay. They were adopted by my client's uncle and aunt, right, who lived in Detroit Lakes. So at that time, they were not domiciled. At the time they adopted, they were not domiciled. They didn't live on the reservation.
Doesn't RS tell us that in an adoptive or pre-adoptive placement proceeding in which the child is not domiciled or resides on the reservation, the tribal court does not have jurisdiction over that proceeding?
It indeed does, Your Honor. And there are two instances in the RS case where the court couldn't have been more emphatic. They said, we conclude ICWA does not permit the transfer of proceedings. So this is a category where they're not residing or domiciled on the reservation. Does not permit the transfer of such proceedings. We further conclude, even if 1911B were ambiguous, this court held that it was an ambiguous statute, state law cannot create jurisdiction in the tribal court where federal law has not.
And federal law has not
right.
Granted jurisdiction in
exactly.
this instance.
And if you look at RS, one of the other subsidiary holdings there was that one of the parents in that case was a non-Indian, and to transfer the case to tribal court would subject the non-Indian non-member to tribal jurisdiction, and that also violated federal law, and they cited the case of the famous Supreme Court case Montana.
So you would hold that out as a separation of powers theory?
What's that?
You would hold that out as a separation of powers theory?
So counsel in their responsive brief said I'm arguably arguing that's a constitutional problem. And good question. And it made me realize and think, okay, there's two kind of prongs to this. There's the preemption argument. The supremacy clause says if you have a conflict between federal law and state law, which one governs? Hello, it's the supremacy clause, right? The constitutional argument, we are not alleging any substantive violation of the state or federal constitution. All we're doing is saying that there's kind of rules that you guys apply when you have a conflict between a statute and a federal decision or a decision on federal law. Supremacy clause says federal law is supreme. It preempts state law notwithstanding. And so the Supreme Court basically, without saying so, said state law is preempted. State law cannot create jurisdiction, so that if the legislature did purport to establish jurisdiction, it would necessarily be preempted by the RS decision. So
that's why I'm looking at the statute the way I am. I'm not hearing anyone or seeing anywhere in these briefs anyone saying, here is the legal authority for a state legislature to create or restrict tribal court jurisdiction. I quite frankly don't know how a state legislature can create tribal court jurisdiction. It comes from federal law or it pre-exists. So if we've got a statute saying you shall transfer this to the jurisdiction of the tribal court, the legislature almost has to presume that that jurisdiction exists in the first place because the legislature can't create it.
Right. And then the Supreme Court went on and said, therefore, the tribal court could assume jurisdiction over the proceeding, if at all, only by congressional grant. Only by congressional grant. And they said that Congress did not grant that jurisdiction to the tribe for adoptive and pre-adoptive proceedings.
So let me ask you this. To get the relief you're seeking, it seems that we have to do one of two things. We either have to say, well, we're going to read the statute, as I've suggested, which is this is not inconsistent with RS. This statute doesn't give jurisdiction where none exists. This statute simply says if there is jurisdiction with the tribal court, you shall transfer it there. Or we have to strike down the statute as somehow attempting to create jurisdiction. If the latter, what's our legal basis for doing that?
I don't think you strike down the statute. And I did a little bit more research on that and questioned what does our Supreme Court do when it holds that a federal statute preempts a state statute? Does it strike it down? I don't think the answer is yes. And I did come across a case, Boyd versus BNSF, 874 Northwest 2nd, 234. And there they were talking about the Fair Employment Labor Act, I think it's FELA, and whether Minnesota can double tax costs under state law. And they said that it was preempted by federal law. And they said that it's preempted accordingly. The Minnesota statute that authorized that, Rule 68.03, does not apply in state court FELA proceedings. So I think you do what they did in that case and just say 260.771 subdivision 3 sub B does not apply.
But to get there, we have to do a preemption analysis, and you haven't really done a preemption analysis for us in your brief.
Well, I'll give you one right now. I think it's there's a field, there's express field and implied preemption. And I think however you cut it, I think it's express because Congress, the Supreme Court deemed it as express by statute, and that also it's field because Congress so occupies the field of establishing jurisdiction over Indian country, so there's no room for the state to interfere and enact statutes in the area of Indian affairs. So I think it's a field. I don't think it's really a complicated
argument.
So Mr.
Fidler, my question is, what is the significance of subdivision one of 260.771 where our legislature has in fact recognize the jurisdiction of the tribal court as set forth in section 1911 A and B of ICWA, specifically referencing jurisdiction and exclusive jurisdiction, whereas in subdivision 3 there's no mention of jurisdiction, it's just talking about transfer. Do we attach any significance to that difference between the way that statute's been drafted and what it's recognized?
Your Honor, when the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act was passed, it largely codified federal law, the Indian Child Welfare Act, and pretty much word for word in most instances grafted that into state law so that it was front and center in the minds of state lawyers. And I think that's what happened with subdivision 3, that mirrors what the Indian Child Welfare Act says, that involuntary proceedings for foster care and termination of parental rights off reservation, not within the jurisdiction, can be transferred. So that's where Congress did grant jurisdiction. under 1911. And I would just ask, Your Honor, I've got nothing else to say here, except, so going back to the Boyd case, I conclude by asking, what if the legislature decided to pass a law clarifying, oh, well, we can double tax costs, notwithstanding what the Supreme Court says? I think the answer to that would be clear. It would be preempted. And the separation of powers issue tells us, going back to Marbury versus Madison, and I raised this, it was interesting, right after RS was decided, the tribe came into the legislature, and I testified that Marbury versus Madison means our Supreme Court decides what the law is, not the legislature. And the legislature apparently thought otherwise. So we would ask that that order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fidler. Respondent counsel.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm Rebecca McConkey-Green. I'm here honored to represent the White Earth Band of Chippewa, which is a federally recognized tribe as part of the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. I'm going to point out to the court that we seem to be traveling down the same path that happened in oral arguments before the Minnesota Supreme Court in the RS and LS decision, and that is ignoring a very basic tenet of Indian law. There are some things about Indian law that are the rights and responsibilities that tribes have that are inherent. They aren't created by any act of Congress. They are not created by case law. They are not even created by treaty. They exist just by the fact that the tribes exist as a political entity and have the rights to do certain things. One of the things that they have long been recognized as having the right to do is to govern and protect their children. They have always had the jurisdiction to do that. They had that long before first contact, and they continue to retain that today.
Were those arguments, though, rejected by the Supreme Court in RS?
I don't recall those arguments actually being made in RS.
Well, the Supreme Court, in its decision, discussed a number of cases from other jurisdictions and that accepted your argument here, but specifically rejected it, saying they've rejected it because they were decided based on what those courts viewed as the spirit of the intent of Congress as opposed to with a language. And so the Supreme Court did, I think, cases from Oklahoma and maybe some other states specifically said 1911B controls.
Okay.
Over that argument.
Since that time, in addition to the legislation that came out of Minnesota, there were also final rules that were promulgated by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and that is binding federal legislation. That recognized in those rules, and that was cited to, I believe, in my brief as well, that recognized the inherent jurisdiction that tribes have always had and actually commented on that because of that inherent jurisdiction, at times it is appropriate to transfer pre-adoptive and adoptive placements to tribal court. And so that is on, in the BIA federal regulations, that it's on page 38,823. And so, you know, that is...
Don't the BIA regulations specifically state that the standards for addressing motions for transfer of pre-adoptive and adoptive placement proceedings are not dictated by ICWA or these regulations?
Thank you for that question. I'm sorry, would you mind repeating it? I didn't quite follow.
The BIA regulations...
Yes.
Recognized inherent authority, but also said that say that the standards for addressing motions for transfer pre-adoptive and adoptive placement proceedings are not dictated by these regulations. So I'm just questioning whether the BIA regulations govern this request for transfer to the extent that the regulations themselves say they don't.
Okay. And I think what I would point out to the court, and thank you for that question, it gives me a good opportunity to talk about something. There's kind of, I think, two different issues here. One of them is, does the tribe inherently have jurisdiction over these issues? And the BIA has recognized that, yes, they do, through passing this rule. The second issue that we have then...
Which rule?
The final rule for Indian child welfare proceedings.
And what does the rule say?
The rule recognizes that there is inherent jurisdiction of the tribe over proceedings, including pre-adoptive and adoptive proceedings.
Yeah, but so but does say pre-adoptive? Or does it distinguish between the residence of the children, whether they're on?
No, it's talking about transfer of cases to tribal court, and that would be usually cases off of the reservation. And it does talk about acknowledging the transfers of court of pre-adoptive and adoptive proceedings.
But under the ICWA provisions?
Yes, I mean, my understanding is the ICWA provisions are...
we all know this isn't adoption following an ICWA case. I mean, this is a guardianship versus a guardianship adoption versus an ICWA-related adoption.
Because it involves people that are not originally the parents caring for the children, would still be an ICWA case. But
despite the adoption that the tribal court issued, the adoption decree that White Earth issued, saying that...
Absolutely. If I would ask you, Your Honor, to please consider it this way. When you look at the Indian Child Welfare Act, there is a very strong emphasis and presumption on the need for state courts to allow the involvement of tribes in proceedings involving their children, and pointing out again that tribes have always governed and protected their children long before there was ICWA, long before the United States existed. So to keep that going, and because the children and the tribes' well-being are so intertwined together, there is this emphasis on involvement of the tribe. It wouldn't make any sense to segregate out one type of third-party custody, for lack of a better way of putting it, or one single...
I understand everything you're saying, but what you want us to do is view this as one continuum, that it started way back at the biological parents when they were no longer deemed parents, and that's the next case that we're going to hear. But you're saying this is just one constant continuum, and we should look at it that way.
I'm fearing that I may be not entirely understanding your question.
Well,
I apologize.
I guess where I struggle is this is adoption two.
Yes.
For this case. I mean, it's adoption two, and at some point, Mr. Fidler is arguing, well, you know, adoption one established where it's at now. The children don't live on the reservation any longer. We've severed that tie, so this is where we're at. And I'm somewhat hearing you say, well, no, it just continues because of the heritage and the cultural issues that are involved, that the tribal court should retain the jurisdiction.
That is something I was talking about with the guardianship action. Specifically with the adoption, I was talking about the jurisdiction of the tribal court. And I'm not claiming that they're, let me back up from that. The jurisdiction of their children is inherent, and there has been case law, and I believe I cited in my brief, that talks about that the jurisdiction is not just over the territory of the tribe, it's over its members regardless of where they are. Okay. So there's always jurisdiction, okay?
So so
the second part, and I do want to answer your question, but I want to make sure that I get this in. What the legislature did in Minnesota then was say their jurisdiction is there, basically acknowledging that. You can transfer, because coming from RS, part of the issue with that decision was there's no authorization anywhere to transfer this. So the Minnesota legislature says, okay, there's jurisdiction there. We are going to authorize transfer of these cases to tribal court. And so, then the BIA...
Unless there's good cause not to.
That's part of the, I would say that there may be a little bit of a difference between what's mandated in ICWA for transfers of foster care proceedings and termination of rights, where you have to find good cause not to transfer those cases. This is a kind of a separate transfer track, I guess, that would go through and
Isn't
would follow
there a
just the MIPA.
Difference between transfer and jurisdiction? Because my question for you is the same I asked Mr. Fidler. It's troubling that in subdivision one of that statute, the legislature specifically adopts these jurisdictional provisions of ICWA in Minnesota law.
Mm-hmm.
But in subdivision three, they make no reference to jurisdiction. There's a presumption that there's already jurisdiction, and it deals only with transfer, yet if the clear reading of subdivision one of that statute would not create jurisdiction. How do we reconcile that?
I would ask you to reconcile
these facts with these kids living off the reservation.
I would ask you to reconcile, just as I have spoken out of, and I apologize if I'm missing something, but the Minnesota legislature, or for that matter, I don't believe the federal legislature creates any jurisdiction for tribes over their members. They've recognized repeatedly that that is inherent, that the tribes have always had that. And so sometimes they acknowledge it, and ICWA acknowledges that jurisdiction. The BIA regulations acknowledge that jurisdiction, and the Minnesota legislature acknowledges that jurisdiction. But they're not creating it.
Why would there be a provision in ICWA? If it's inherent, a given, then why would the legislature say, under these circumstances where the kids live here, under these type of proceedings, there's jurisdiction, but in these circumstances, in these types of cases where the kids don't live on the reservation, there is no jurisdiction?
I don't, Your Honor, I would disagree, respectfully disagree. I don't agree that that's what the statute says. I think what the statute is saying in 1911, when it's talking about transfer of foster care proceedings and termination of parental rights proceedings, is you transfer these cases to tribal court absent good cause. If not, it's not creating the jurisdiction. It's creating almost a rule or a mandate that these go when the tribe or the parents request them to go to tribal court. And so it's a very strong presumption in favor of tribal court jurisdiction, and I think that's been talked about in a number of cases as well. It's not creating the jurisdiction. It is saying that there is concurrent jurisdiction here, and it goes to this, to the tribe when the tribe has requested it, absent good cause.
1911 talks about exclusive tribal jurisdiction.
In one part, and yes.
Counsel, I think I understand your argument to be that what the legislature did in 260.771 subdivision 3B is recognize the inherent jurisdiction of tribal courts. Yes. In proceedings governing Indian children. So the legislature wasn't creating jurisdiction, but simply recognizing it and mandating a transfer. The problem I have with that proposed reading of the statute is in RS, the Supreme Court said in that case, the tribal court lacked inherent jurisdiction over the termination of parental rights proceeding because the child and parents, neither the child nor the parents were domiciled on the writer's reservation, and cited Montana v. United States, a U.S. Supreme Court case, which says tribe lacked inherent power to regulate activities of non-tribal members on non-Indian land. So we seem to have a case from the United States Supreme Court and from the Minnesota Supreme Court that say inherent jurisdiction of the tribal court does not apply to kids or parents who are not domiciled or residing on the reservation. How do we get around that law and write an opinion that says this statute's fine, it recognizes the tribal court's inherent jurisdiction over kids that don't reside on the reservation, when that is inconsistent with Minnesota Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court case law?
Those statutory authorizations for transfer and recognizing the tribal court inherent jurisdiction came after this decision, and the court is required to apply the law in place at the time.
Wait a second. When you say what came after what decision?
The Minnesota statute, MIFPA, the 260.771.
Okay. By what authority? Then what you're saying is what the legislature purportedly did in the statute was created jurisdiction. Because we have Minnesota Supreme Court and U.S. Supreme Court both saying tribal court does not have inherent jurisdiction over Indian children not domiciled on the reservation. And you're proposing that what this statute does is say, yes, the tribal court does have inherent jurisdiction over those children. By what authority does the legislature get to determine whether or not the tribal court has inherent jurisdiction over Indian children not domiciled on the reservation, when the highest court of this land and the Minnesota Supreme Court have said that is not the case?
I don't agree with your interpretation of Montana. I think that's talking about non-members not on the reservation, if I'm not mistaken. Tribes have maintained jurisdiction and inherently and has not been removed over their member children even off the reservation. And so
okay.
I would ask you to consider it that way.
I stand corrected. So it was a non-tribal member.
Right. And so tribes have always, and I believe and I'm sorry I don't have it right in front of me, but I cited two cases, I believe, in my brief that talk about that the jurisdiction that tribes have is not just over their territory, it is also over their members, even when the members are not on the reservation. I think that's not in many ways dissimilar to what happens with other sovereigns when their citizens are elsewhere. And so I think that's pretty consistent with international law that way. You know, the jurisdiction of tribes over their members' children hasn't been removed in any way other than what the language that we had in the RSNLS decision. And the Indian Child Welfare Act recognizes, I know Mr. Fidler talked about whether the Minnesota legislature has a right to go in and to make laws that change that or whether that's preempted. But the preemption, as I understand it, usually is only present when it's very clear from the statute that they meant to leave no room for the state to come in and regulate, because there, for many types of federal legislation, there is actually kind of a need for some state definition and regulation of what's going on. ICWA actually has a provision in it that recognizes that there will, in fact, be a state legislation in regard to proceedings involving Indian children. Section 1921 of the Indian Child Welfare Act provides that whichever, either ICWA or federal law or state law, provides greater protections to the children and families is what should prevail. So the Minnesota legislature can't go in and restrict anything in ICWA, but they certainly have the right to go in and provide additional rights for the children. I see that I'm out of time, and if there's no other questions, I will end. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McConkie-Green. And Mr. Fidler, in this case, you get the last word.
Your Honors, I hate it when lawyers say I'll be brief, but I'm going to say it. I will.
You only get 5 minutes.
But I will be brief. I really don't have a lot to add. I would just point out, Judge Larkin, you hit the nail on the head by citing the language right in RS. It talks about Supreme Court precedent. It talks about...
Right, but in that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court also noted that in addition to not residing on the reservation, that the record indicated that RS was not an Indian child or not Native American. So is that a significant difference here?
No, in fact, it's probably more on point, because in RS, one of the parents was not a Native American, and they had concerns about transferring a non-Native American's case to the reservation, and that's where you get into Montana, because Montana was the right of the tribe to regulate non-members. And likewise here, what the legislature did is it was very kind of blunt instrument drafting. You know, if they wanted to parallel the ICWA, they would have had the same good cause language to object. There's no parent with the right to object to transfer under subdivision B. There is under ICWA, and there was under subdivision 3A. So the parent can object. But here, so do they really mean that the biological parent can object to transfer? Well, they're not going to do that. So what if you're the guardian, and why doesn't the guardian have the basis of one saying Montana means you don't have jurisdiction over me, that there's good cause to not transfer?
And here the kids are Indian children. They're tribal members, are eligible for enrollment in the tribe?
I believe they are members, Your Honor.
Members.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm having some concern about whether RS is as dispositive as you claim, for two reasons. It seems that one significant difference between this case and RS is in RS we were dealing with a parent who was not a Native American. Do we have that concern here?
You know, you can parse it that way if you'd like, but I think the safer thing and the more straightforward reading of RS is it's a jurisdiction only can be created by Congress.
Okay.
And they did not do so, and they didn't delineate on the basis of whether on the race of the person whose case was to be transferred.
Well, only on, but it delineated as to the inherent jurisdiction argument. So to the extent that RS rejected an argument about inherent jurisdiction, it noted that RS is not Native American. So I wonder if that does make some difference here in terms of
RS,
tribal court's inherent jurisdiction.
To disagree with counsel, off-reservation jurisdiction was never pre-existing, even before ICWA. And that's why Congress had to create it. If the tribes had a jurisdiction over people off the reservation, then they wouldn't have needed to codify 1911B to transfer it, but they did. But we do know, under Fisher versus District Court, the jurisdiction of tribal court over proceedings for adoption is exclusive, but that's where everybody resides on the reservation. And that's why Congress really was codifying existing law when they passed 1911A. 1911B is a new creature. And you would dramatically expand the scope of what Congress intended by authorizing subdivision
3B. So you're saying there is no inherent jurisdiction over Indian children who are not domiciled on the reservation?
No. Minnesota has jurisdiction. They're citizens of the United States. They're citizens of Minnesota.
And then as the Supreme Court said in RS, lacking inherent jurisdiction, the tribal court could assume jurisdiction over the proceeding, if at all, only by congressional grant, and we don't have the congressional grant under ICWA.
Right.
We have a state statute.
But which is not a congressional grant.
And if the argument is, well, the state statute is a recognition of inherent jurisdiction, and inherent jurisdiction doesn't apply to kids who are off reservation, calls into question the validity of the statute.
It's very problematic, Your Honor. So we would ask you reverse. Thank you. Unless there's no more questions.
Thank you. Matters in this proceeding were well argued and well briefed. They are under advisement. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. Now, as promised, this is a little unusual where we have appellant counsel switching spots. The court's going to take a stretch break, but also because we have some students that are going to be, we thought they were going to be in the courtroom observing, I'll ask Mr. Huff, our marshal, to make sure that they're in the ante room, if there's certainly not enough room for the students. So everybody go ahead and take a stretch break and move yourselves.
Got 3 minutes?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Certainly.
My water. You got your water on the switch.
Oh
my gosh. I know.
Hey, you saw the letter where they're splitting their time on
mm-hmm. Yeah,
site.
I did. I asked him to step out and see where the students were, if there was going to be room to come in, or if they were in the ante room.
They're in the lawyer's
prep
room right now.
And then they're going to come in here afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do we assume that everyone who was here before?
I don't know. I was surprised that everyone stepped out. We didn't recess for the simple reason it takes too long to reconfigure.
Right. Got it.
I think it's going to be fall.
I think so, too. I think it's the
same. They left their coats.
It's the same case.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a different issue.
All right. Sounds good.
In the front row?
Mm-hmm.
No idea. Oh, but she's got a tag.
That's what I was wondering on the screen. So are you here? No, we have no. We're not.
Nothing left. Canceled next week.
Then the week after that, you're gone.
No, the week after that, I think.
Oh, okay.
I think I'm here on the 12th, and it's the following.
All right. That's what Les
messages, and then she'll bring them in afterwards. Okay. I think everybody is going to be coming back in. That was... Okay. All right. Why don't you see if you can get everyone to come back in? It looks like more of a talking break than it was.
Yeah, I'm understanding why there was a need, quite frankly.
Yeah, I think it was just a discussion. So go ahead and move everyone back in. I don't want to be presumptuous. Are you Mr. Boulet?
I am Mr. Boulet, yes.
Boulet. Everyone, go ahead and sit down, yes. Mr. Huff, it does appear there is seating available in the courtroom if the students wish to come in instead of watching on ITV. I don't know how many are here.
I'll go look them down.
Oh, there's more coming in.
There's like, there was, could have been a maximum of 15, I thought.
Probably room for six or seven, eight if they squeeze. I'm not sure what the age group is of the children. Council, too, for this matter, we have some homeschooled students that are observing today, and if you have time afterwards, they have all sorts of questions about the legal process. Feel free to engage in discussion with them. They're going to talk to us for a little bit first, so when you're done with this hearing, I'm going to ask that you clear the courtroom just so we can start our conference with the students.
They're homeschool students?
A group of homeschool students, yes.
I don't think there's going to be room.
Oh, all right. Now we've filled up again. All right. We've all had our break. I'm going to ask our marshal to call the next...